Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman and this is the Sunday Roundup. With just over a week to go until the planned unlocking of all government restrictions, the Vaccines Minister Nadeem Zahawi joined Andrew Marr to discuss what would happen next. Zahawi suggested that some aspects of daily life could look very similar to now.
The fortification of the vaccination programme has allowed us to cautiously move to step four, and the PM will say more about this. The guidelines will be very clear on things like mask wearing. There's an expectation of people to wear masks indoors, in crowded places, on public transport. There's both a personal responsibility and a corporate responsibility. So rather than governed by diktat, what we're saying is we move to step four cautiously. All the border controls and the stringent border
controls
continue.
You're moving from must to please.
No, we're moving from must to you are expected to wear a mask in indoor spaces, on crowded trains and elsewhere. That will help the whole country.
Marr challenged Zahawi over Boris Johnson's claim that the link between COVID infections and serious cases of the disease had been severed.
We talk a lot about the Prime Minister and words and so forth, but that is wrong, isn't it? We have not severed the link.
Well, I watched the Prime Minister at that press conference that
But that wasn't the press conference. That was the House of Commons,
and he said severed the link. We have severely weakened the link between infection rates. So at the current infection rates, if this was without the vaccination programme, we'd have 500-600 people being in hospital.
So Nadeem Zahawi, the Prime Minister, was wrong, wasn't he?
So what I'm saying to you is the Prime Minister agrees with his chief scientific advisor and his chief medical advisor that we have severely weakened the link through the vaccination programme.
Did he mislead the House of Commons when he said the link had been severed?
No, I think, look, we're dancing on the head of a pin here.
We're not. It's severed. It's not
no,
true.
No, we're dancing on the head of a pin. What the PM is saying, and he looks at the data on a daily basis, that if you look at where we are in terms of case numbers today and what is happening in hospitals, it's a very different look. I just gave you the number.
Well, you did, but this is really important because people are going to have to make choices themselves. And we see the number of case rates shooting up and we see the number of hospitalizations rising quite fast as well. So if people think that the link has been severed, they will behave in one way. And if they don't think it's been severed, they'll behave in another way. This is not a kind of irrelevant heads of pin thing. This is quite important. And I say again, the Prime Minister was wrong to say the link has been severed.
Well, I would go back and say to you, in the press conference...
I'm just asking for a yes.
No, but Andrew, I know what you're asking for. Mm. Ultimately, the Prime Minister agrees with his chief scientific advisor that we have severely weakened that link, and you see it in the numbers. We have to be cautious. On Monday, he will stand up at another press conference and will say we have severely weakened that link.
Yes, okay.
Trevor Phillips interviewed the Shadow Education Secretary, Kate Green, who told him that the government should not be leaving mask wearing up to chance.
People want to wear masks. Most people feel more comfortable and confident when others are wearing masks around them. And I think this, oh, we'll leave it up to individuals, people can take personal responsibility, that's a recipe for confusion. I'm afraid it's probably a recipe for more confrontations. And I just think it would be much clearer and simpler for the government to keep mandatory mask wearing in public places in place after the 19th of July.
The two mayors of the largest cities, or first and third largest cities, Sadiq Khan and Andy Burnham, have the tube and the tram under their control. Will they be requiring a mandatory mask on those forms of transport? It's in their hands. What is Labour going to say about that?
I hope they will, and I believe, I think I'm right in saying that Andy has already indicated that here in Manchester, that's what he will do. I certainly think that having travelled regularly on both the tube and the tram all through the pandemic when I was allowed to, that wearing masks and seeing others wearing masks is a source of great reassurance and people want to do it.
Green also told Phillips why Labour would be opposing the government's higher education bill, which is aimed at combating cancel culture in universities.
You've issued a statement today about the government's plan for legislation against hate speech in higher education. And what you said, or what the party has said in its release, is Labour say the law is trying to solve a problem that doesn't exist. Let me read you some names. J.K. Rowling, Julie Bindle, Amber Rudd, Selena Todd, Kevin Price. You know what they've all got in common? They have all been cancelled. In fact, one of them's lost their job over the what they have said about the issue of women as a sex, as opposed to the view that's taken by some trans rights activists that there is no such thing, essentially. Now, are you really saying that there is nothing to see here? This problem doesn't exist?
There are, and always have been, a very small number of instances. And I think those examples that you gave, in many cases, perhaps in all cases, I'm not familiar with every single one of those examples, Trevor.
I could have given you another dozen.
Well, please, but Trevor, in the last year for which we have data, out of 10,000 events, only 6 were cancelled. 4 because they had the wrong paperwork. 1 went to another venue. 1 was a pyramid scheme. If you look across the piece, there are a very small number of events that are cancelled. I think there is obviously a concern about the atmosphere, the climate on campus, but that cuts both ways. And if we have, as I believe this legislation does, a law that allows people actually to come on campus as Holocaust deniers, to spread hate speech, anti-vaxxers, I don't think that's in the public interest. And I think that has a chilling effect. And I think we don't need this legislation. And I think that this actually gives succour to people who want to sow hate and division, and to their lawyers.
I don't think we make good law
on the basis of a small number of cases.
Ma spoke to the Cambridge statistician David Spiegelhalter and asked him about the likely rate of hospitalisations if COVID cases hit the Health Secretary's predicted level of 100,000 a day over the summer.
Yeah, it's interesting because the hospitalisation rate as a proportion of cases, say a week before, you know, has dropped a lot. It used to be in the second wave, it was about 1 in 10, and now it's about 1 in 40 because the cases are so much younger. But that would mean that 100,000 cases, if we got there, would be maybe, you know, 2,500 admissions a day. You know, that's very high. It's considerably lower than the peak in the second wave. And as I said, they would be younger, less severe, the shorter stays. So the actual numbers in hospital would still be well below the second wave peak, even if we did hit that 100,000 a day. But of course, it's very disruptive having COVID cases. And there would, of course, be a lot of bad outcomes. But I guess the judgment is that it's better we do it now than in the winter.
Sure, and it is a very, very difficult judgment. We're hearing quite a lot of concern from inside the NHS about those kind of numbers and whether it's possible to, for instance, start to clear the backlog of cases, start to deal with the cancer and all the rest of it, and deal with 2,500 cases of COVID coming in every day.
I think that would be a real challenge for the NHS, and actually made worse hugely by the fact that over the summer, again, I think it's inevitable that millions of people will be told to self-isolate, either by being pinged by the app or through NHS Test and Trace. And there's already just been an announcement that vaxxed NHS staff, you know, may not have to do that, because otherwise it's not just the NHS, but in all, everything we're doing is going to be massively disruptive because of the self-isolation rules. Actually, you know, few people told to self-isolate actually have an infection, and especially if they're vaxxed. And so I do think it makes sense to get this in proportion to actually what are the benefits of this massive disruption.
The Chief of the Defence Staff, General Sir Nick Carter, spoke to Ma about the situation in Afghanistan after 20 years of military action.
Thinking of all the people who've died or are currently you know, severely disabled as a result of that long, long engagement, do you think it was worth it?
I think it's a very challenging question. I think it slightly depends on how Afghanistan how it turns out. But I think what one has to remember is that ourselves and the Americans went to the south of Afghanistan, and for that matter, the east of Afghanistan, and took the insurgency on in its heartlands. And in doing that, as part of an international coalition, we created the conditions for the civil society I described earlier to flourish elsewhere in Afghanistan. So it's a collaborative effort, as these things so often are. Now, the plain fact is that not a day goes by without me thinking of the 457 British military who lost their lives in Afghanistan. And I think that all of us can hold our heads up high who fought there, because we weren't defeated tactically on the battlefield, and our military showed phenomenal courage and remarkable adaptability against what was a very, very challenging opponent.
You mentioned civil society just now. There's a story in the papers today, in the Sunday Times today, about billionaires stepping in to try to plug some of the gap of the fall in British aid. Does cutting British aid abroad risk destabilising societies overseas?
I think the key thing is making sure the aid is spent wisely. And I think that if you join it up with foreign policy and with security policy in a more connected way, then I think you've probably got a better chance of making sure that aid is spent wisely, as indeed in many parts of Afghanistan it has been spent very wisely.
And finally, ahead of the final of the Euro 2020 Football Championships, Tom Newton-Dunn and I spoke to the Italian ambassador to the UK, Raffaele Trombetta, about whether football was really coming home.
If England does win the game tonight and we win the European Cup, you'll, of course, remember that we invented football in England. You'll agree that football's coming home.
It depends what you mean with football coming home. I mean, if you go back to when the football was invented, yes. But then coming home is also if we win. Because after all, you know, we have in our palmarès, as we said, 4 World Cup, already another European Cup. So from this point of view, even if it started in England, maybe it has developed better in other countries, including mine.
Oh, that's a strong statement, Mr. Ambassador. You have to admit,
it's the reality of history. It's what has happened in the last few decades. And it's a reality. It's not something that I'm making up.
That's all for this week. I'm Isabel Hardman, and this podcast was produced by Matthew Taylor. Don't forget to subscribe to the Coffeehouse Shots podcast on the iTunes Store. And if you enjoyed this podcast, do subscribe to our daily Evening Blend email. It's a free roundup of all the political news each day, along with analysis and a diary on what to expect next. Just go to spectator.co.uk/eveningblend. Thanks for listening, and do join us again next week.